Well, I want you to take a listen to this clip from a protest in the South.
Warnings of arrest, threats of jail terms, all fail to put out what burns in the hearts and minds of the youngsters.
Youngsters, that recording is from the 1960s. It was coverage of a sit-in protest. If you ask most people who was the leader of the civil rights movement back then, they'll say Martin Luther King Jr. But the movement had many leaders, women who never really emerged into the spotlight, young people as well, including Morehouse College students Julian Bond and Lonnie King. They were the founding chairman of the Atlanta Civil Student Movement. Today we see the beginnings of another civil rights movement. People are coming together to speak out against police brutality, voter discrimination, institutional racism. But some critics say this one is a leaderless effort. Creative Loafing senior staff writer Rodney Carmichael disagrees with that term, leaderless, and he's been covering one particular leader since last year. Her name is Arielle Lussier. She co-founded the It's Bigger Than You movement and led a protest outside the CNN Center in the wake of teenager Michael Brown's death last summer. Rodney's written a piece for Creative Loafing on both the old and the new guard of civil rights leaders in Atlanta. I highly recommend you read it. It's a long read, but a very good one. It's called A Year and Some Change. Rodney Carmichael, Arielle Lussier, and Lonnie King are here now to talk about it. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Rodney, I wanted to start with you because in your piece pretty early on, you call today's activists the forsaken grandchildren of the civil rights movement. What does that mean?
Well, I think it speaks to the generational divide that kind of occurred because the baton wasn't properly passed down from the civil rights generation to this younger generation today. And so I think in a lot of ways they missed a lot of the knowledge, the strategy, and you know, just a lot of things that their grandparents practice during the original civil rights movement.
So Lonnie, that's you. that's you that we're talking about. And this was a pretty common thing in many of the people that Rodney spoke to while he was covering this. What happened? Do you think the baton was not passed down?
Well, let me preface it this way. The sordid history of the South on the issue of race is something that I think most people really don't want to deal with. I think I was responsible for maybe not passing on the baton, partly because I didn't want to tell my children how bad things were. Mm. Most parents don't want to tell their children bad things. If the rent is due, you don't go tell your child. You go get the rent and you pay the rent. Unfortunately, looking back now after so many years, we really believed that the South would change. All you had to do was change the law, and at some point they would begin to do the right thing. We were wrong, but let me just give you a little illustration of what I'm talking about. Many of us, I'm looking now in hindsight, put our effort towards freedom on a highway. At some point, we hold these truths to be self-evident. We'll reach that one day. For the last 50 years, we have, to a great extent, been driving our car towards freedom on cruise control. However, the people that we were battling in the 1960s, they're on that same highway, and they've been spending their time over the last 50 years trying to turn this around, and they had their car in overdrive. So they changed the law. They gutted the voting rights law. They got rid of affirmative action. They changed the South from racist Democrats to racist Republicans, on and on and on. So here I am now after 50-some years of looking and working, and I'm saying, you know, we have not passed this baton on. But all is not lost. We can do a job now. I hope that the young folks who may be listening would understand one thing. You cannot bring a society into what it should be doing without organizing. We have to organize. The reason that we won in the 1960s was that we organized thousands and thousands of people who had one goal. We have the possibility to still do that today. I can say more about it later on.
Well, let me bring you to one of the young people sitting next to you, Arielle.
Yes.
You said, and I'm going to quote you here, you said, we believed in this idea that the same people who got us desegregation in the 60s were ready to strap up their boots again, or at least were ready to pass on the torch and pass down the knowledge, and we were sadly mistaken.
Yeah, I think that for a long time I was saying that I didn't mean to co-found It's Bigger Than You. And we, when Michael Brown was first killed and the unrest was happening in Ferguson, the first thing we did was call our grandmother's folk, right? We called National Action Network. We called the SCLC. We called the NAACP. And, you know, there was talk about, you know, who we had
to
make
a Southern Christian Leadership Council.
Yes, yeah, right. I'm sorry. Yes.
And the National Association for Advancement of Colored People.
Yes.
Okay, keep going.
And we were told to, you know, make appointments. And we were told, you know, people were unavailable. And we essentially had doors slammed in our face when we were looking at an unrest that, you know, we haven't seen on American soil in decades. And it was disheartening for us because I believed so profoundly in the work that happened in the civil rights movement. And it was something that inspired me from as young an age as 8. And to see those same people, the same people who had, you know, really stood in the face of batons, who had put their lives on the line, like I knew in August that I was ready to do, turn their backs almost. We knew that we weren't willing to wait, and neither was the rest of the country, as we've seen over the past almost year now. And so we strapped up our boots, and we knew that we didn't have all the knowledge and we didn't have all the tools, but I mean, what we knew best was social media, and we knew the masses that social media could bring out. And so I put my number out on Twitter. My actual phone number, and it's, you know, something.
You're regretting that now, aren't you?
I regretted it almost immediately. The flyer that we put out trended, and we thought we would have 500 at CNN Center, and 5,000 were there. And then we've been continually gathering people out in the streets and bringing those people into not only protesting and being the front lines of resistance, but also building infrastructure in communities so that we can hold leadership accountable and shift policy and shift people power.
See, here's the irony for me, Arielle, listening to you talking about not intending to co-found your movement, but you did, and you're now a leader of it. But Lonnie, when you talk about the beginnings of this for you, I mean, you met Julian Bond while you were standing in line waiting to register at Morehouse, did you not?
Yes.
So, I mean, it seems as though you kind of accidentally fell into a leadership role as well. Is that fair?
I wouldn't say I accidentally fell into it. I was prepared for it. I spent 3 years in the Navy. When the young men sat down in Greensboro, I read about it in the Atlanta Constitution a day or so later. I was down at Yasey Milton's drugstore, and I was talking to my good friend Joseph Pierce. And I said, "Joe, have you read this?" And Joe told me he hadn't. He read it. And I said, "We need to organize. Those kids in Greensboro should not be alone." And he agreed. And so I said, "Now, the guy over there," I said, "I met him in 57 when I came back from the Navy. He's a writer." I said, "We need somebody who can also write the story of what we're doing." And so we went over to see Julian, and he agreed to do it, reluctantly, but he did agree to do it. His point was, well, somebody's going to do it. My point was, no, we're going to make it happen. You have to be assertive if you're going to deal with the situation. You can't be reluctant and stand back. But let me just tell you, it's a whole lot easier today, in my view, than it was then. You may not find as many people coming to your house nowadays to kill you as we had during that period of time.
Let me ask Arielle, would you agree with that? Do you think it's easier now than then?
I can't say that I agree. And I do understand that racism was a fricative thing in the 60s and the 70s. And it was in your face. The officers back then had every right to pull you out of your car and beat you and then send you on your way. Teachers had every right to, spit on the students who had just desegregated their classrooms. It was in your face, and there was combative, and there was no getting around it. But today, not only are we fighting the exact same beast, I say all the time that Jim Crow has just slipped on a new suit. There's so many laws and there's so many constructs that mirror exactly what was going on in the 60s. Not only are we battling that, but we're also having to plead and having to prove that there is, in fact, a race issue in America. So many people want to unburden themselves with the idea that we're still
we're
dealing with. Right, we're post-racial. We have a black president. There's especially in Atlanta, we're the black mecca of the South. And that causes a lot of people, both black, white, and otherwise, to be satiated. And so we have to fight all the more harder, because there is no there's not often a video that can, you know, where an officer beats a black boy or shoots a black boy and then says, I did this because you're black. It's, you know, oh, he scared me. And the language has shifted. It's more concealed.
And this is part, Rodney, of what you were getting at in terms of the difference in strategies and the different kind of leaders we have now. You say we have a more covert kind of racism, which I think is what Arielle is talking about. How does that change the strategy?
Wow. Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that question, but I think that the young people have been doing a good job. I think even more so than focusing on strategy, I think it's important to understand the difference in leadership models that they're using today. You know, this movement is a lot more progressive. It's a lot more inclusive, and a lot of the people who weren't allowed to participate in the frontline leadership roles in the 60s are now. And so,
especially the gay community.
Yeah, the gay community, definitely, and women in general. And so they have a different style of leadership, but it is a style that is also rooted in a lot of civil rights era leadership as well. I just think that, you know, the kind of patriarchal, charismatic, coming out of the church model was so prominent and you know, effective then, that people think if it doesn't look like that, it must not be a movement. Or if it doesn't look like that, these must not be real leaders.
We're talking to civil rights leader Lonnie King, who founded the Atlanta Student Movement in 1960. And Arielle Lussier is also with us. She's the co-founder and spokesperson for It's Bigger Than You, which grew out of the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Also with us, journalist Rodney Carmichael is here. He wrote about Lonnie, Arielle, and other local civil rights leaders for his creative loafing piece called A Year and Some Change. Just before we went to break, Rodney was talking about the difference in the leadership of today's movement as opposed back in the 1960s. And Lonnie, you wanted to clarify something, I think.
Yes, if I don't clarify this, I can't go home. Mr. Coleman... You made the comment,
Mr. Carmichael. Yeah,
Mr. Carmichael. I'm sorry. You made the comment that the ladies were not that involved. That was kind of the way.
Well,
you
no,
said.
Weren't the leaders.
No.
But I wasn't exactly saying that. But please go ahead.
Yeah. Let me explain.
Okay.
55% of all the folks who went to jail in the 1960s in Atlanta were female. Mm-hmm. The ladies were the people who always showed up. we did have ladies who were leaders also. Also, we had gays who came in. We had whites who came in. It was a kind of an early rainbow movement of a lot of people from Agnes Scott, Georgia State, believe it or not, Georgia Tech, Emory, along with all the six schools from the AU Center. If there's anything I would suggest to the new generation is that you've got to organize. The reason why our boycott was so successful in Atlanta, our movement, was because we literally put together a citywide boycott, asking our people who were African Americans and other people of goodwill to not shop downtown. Richard's department store lost $10 million in 1960 over the Christmas holidays. And so when I called the press conference on the 1st of February to extend it through Easter, within 6 weeks we had signed an agreement for the first time in the South to desegregate.
Here's the thing, though, and I think the Rodney's point, which I get, is that if you ask people or look at the textbooks and look at the leaders of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, there's pretty much, I mean, they may mention one particular female, but other than that, we're going to see John Lewis, we're going to see you, we're going to see Martin Luther King. For the most part, the people who were front and center, whose pictures were in the paper, reporters went to for comment, were mostly not. I don't want to get caught up on this particular point, but I just wanted to mention that
I'll speak to it in 30 seconds. First of all, you had Diane Nash up in Nashville, who was an outstanding leader. You had Hershel Sullivan, who was here in Atlanta, Marion Wright Edelman, who now heads the Children's Defense Fund. But America suffers from a lot of problems, and one of them is a racial problem, but another one is a sexism problem.
Yeah. Women have not gotten their due.
That's right.
And either then or now.
Well, that brings us right back to you, Arielle. One of the things that Rodney asks in his piece is Atlanta's black middle class too comfortable for outrage? I wonder what your response is to that.
I grew up for a good bubble of my childhood as someone who was considered middle class. And then, unfortunately, my family went through hard times after the recession. But for a while, we were middle class. And the attitude of a lot of people in what is considered the black Mecca of the South is that, you know, the middle class, the significance that someone has when they have financial stability is what it is to be free. And unfortunately, the picture that I try to paint all the time is when you are walking down the street on the way home and you are confronted by an officer who doesn't believe that your life as a black person matters. You can't pull out a tax stub or a paycheck and say, you know, I make this much money and therefore you must value me. No, it doesn't work that way. And so unfortunately, we have seen a stagnant sort of era happen because Atlanta was so fortunate for a lot of black people, and it was so we were so financially progressive here, and unfortunately that hasn't saved us. It hasn't.
So Rodney, this criticism that the new movement is leaderless, this really gets under your skin.
Okay.
Why does it bother you that people are saying this movement is leaderless?
Well, I mean, I think that that a lot of times when if you look at the people who are saying that, a lot of times they have an agenda themselves to perhaps be the leader. So I really don't think it's as much an honest and sincere criticism as it is. I guess not only is it kind of divisive, I feel like it really kind of foregoes or takes away from all of the efforts that a lot of people who would not have been leaders at the forefront in the past have put into effect.
I think it's just what you said earlier, because we aren't, you know, coming, you know, marching from the church to the courthouse because it's not, you know, strong, charismatic black men or strong, charismatic men of color speaking on behalf of the whole. A lot of people have misconceptions about, you know, what is happening on the ground, not just here in Atlanta, but across the country. There's a misconception that young people aren't organizing both in the streets and behind closed doors to dismantle legislation and to combat infrastructures that uphold ideals that are both inherently racist and incredibly anti-black. There's a misconception that young black children and young black teens and young black adults aren't capable of sustaining long-term resistance against a system that does not value their lives. There's a misconception that because I'm a black queer woman, or because someone is black and trans, or because someone is black and gay, that they aren't worthy of having the spotlight. They aren't worthy of standing in the front when we too put our bodies on the line, not just now, but also in the 60s and 70s. And so we do everything we can to combat these misconceptions. We do everything we can to bring the masses out into the streets, young and old, black and white, and then make sure that those same masses are voting, make sure those same masses are standing in resistance to legislation that doesn't uphold value on our lives. There's a lot of misconceptions about what's happening, and I realize we're young, it's new, it's been only a year, and the bus boycott itself lasted 388 days. But these are the misconceptions that must be addressed, just as this post-racial era must be addressed.
That's Arielle Lussier. You can hear the passion there. Lonnie King as well, and Rodney Carmichael in a conversation that hopefully will continue as we move forward. Thanks so much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
You can find Rodney's piece at Creative Loafing Atlanta's website. That's CLATL.com. We've also posted it on our Facebook page.